From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The world is getting its first look at the inside of Notre Dame a day after that fire raged through the medieval cathedral and threatened to destroy one of the world's architectural treasures. Let's go now to Charlie James in Paris. She's a journalist with France 24. Charlie, what are you hearing today about how much damage the cathedral appears to have sustained?
There is a bit of a sense of relief this morning here in Paris. It was unclear last night as people were going to bed and the firefighters were continuing through the night to battle these flames, whether or not the main structure of the cathedral would remain intact, especially the main bell towers, the two in the front. It does look like that is going to survive. The main stone structure is going to survive. What is unclear right now, we are getting some images from inside the cathedral, but it's unclear how much of that has been damaged. It's safe to assume that the roof, the wooden beams at the top, those are likely entirely gone. But there's other very important parts of the church, such as the organ and statues and artwork and engravings that couldn't be removed, that couldn't be taken out. And it's unclear at this point exactly how much of that is damaged. But the government is saying, you know, restoration, it's going to be a multi-year, perhaps a decade-long process, take hundreds of millions of dollars. But the French president, Emmanuel Macron, has said he is going to call on the finest artisans in France to come and be a part of this restoration. So while last night everyone was going to bed with a sense of sadness, a real sense of fear and sadness, there is some hope this morning that, you know, with the donations coming in and with the real sense of effort that's being put behind this, that it will once again be able to be restored.
It's kind of amazing that it's still standing, given the images yesterday of that fire just burning and burning and burning for hours and hours. It did hold up. The structure held up.
It did. And part of that is that the firefighters had to make a decision when they arrived on the scene. It took a little while for a large amount of the fire brigade to get there. Notre Dame is on an island. It's not the most accessible cathedral to get to in the city. I arrived not long after the fire broke out, and I was still able to get very close to the cathedral. And we were all fearing the worst. When you saw the amount of smoke, the amount of flames, and you're watching the roof and the spire collapse little by little, there was a real sense of fear that this was it for the cathedral, that it would never be able to be rebuilt. The firefighters did have to make a decision. Are we going to try to keep some of the roof, keep some of the spire, or are we going to really protect those bell towers in the front? And that's what they decided to do. And it does look like that was the right call. But standing there watching in the crowd, it was very surreal. I mean, it's hard to express how important this building, this monument is in the collective memory of France. It's more than just a church. It's more than a tourist attraction. The amount of significance it has in culture, in art, in songs, it really is just a part of the French consciousness. And to see something like that ablaze in front of your eyes, it's very surreal. I don't think as Americans we have a real equivalent to this building and what it means to us. So I'd say that the main feeling standing in the crowds watching it was just complete disbelief and shock that this could be on fire, something so important.
What are we learning today about how this fire may have started?
So there is an investigation underway. We don't know yet the cause. The authorities are saying that it looks like it was connected to the restoration efforts that were underway. And if you look at where the worst of the damage is around the scaffolding, that appears consistent with that as well, that it looks like it came from the center where this work had started. They have also said that it does not look like this was deliberate. It looks like it was an accident. So it will probably take time. They're interviewing, you know, the people who were working there at the time. I assume it will take a little while before we know the full story, but it does appear like it was an accident. And that was a little bit of a relief to people who feared, you know, when they started seeing smoke, that there was some sort of attack, that this was a deliberate attack on the city and one of its most famous and beloved landmarks. So it does, of course, it's terrible. It's a terrible accident, but also knowing that this was not a purposeful destruction, I think is going to be helpful as well for the French people moving forward.
That is Charlie James in Paris from France 24. Charlie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there may also be some comfort in that this won't be the first time Notre Dame has risen. As we've been reminded, in the early 19th century, the huge building was crumbling. In 1831, Victor Hugo wrote his now classic novel, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, a story of the love of the deformed, deaf, and partially blind bell ringer Quasimodo, maybe a stand-in for the decaying building, for the beautiful Esmeralda, perhaps a symbol of France. The novel captivated the country and directly led to the cathedral's total rebirth. A new sacristy, the spire we watched tumble yesterday, gargoyles, a new organ, and more. MIT cultural historian Catherine Clark has been thinking about this. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you told us that you were just teaching this to your students. You know, so many have said that the real star of the book is Notre Dame. What do you say?
I think that's true. The real star of the book is the cathedral. And it's like when you read Moby Dick and you skip all the parts about the whale paintings. Notre Dame is a book that is largely about the cathedral. There are two full chapters that are descriptions of the cathedral, and the story has been added in order to flesh out why this building matters.
And what a story. I mean, I recommend people find the original 1939 film. Let's listen to just a little bit. Quasimodo, the recluse hunchback, swinging along the building's facade. Esmeralda, accused of being a witch. She's going to be hung right on the plaza outside. In this 1939 version, she's approached by a priest on the plaza as she kneels. Esmeralda, played by Maureen O'Hara.
You've been kind to me. I kneel before you, innocent of crime.
I believe you. I cannot allow this girl to do public penance on holy ground because she is not guilty. Then she will hang without public penance. You won't dare. She is a witch and must die. Take it away.
And the crowd, the mob gathered, goes nuts. She is going to be hung when the hunchback, played by Charles Laughton, looking like a human gargoyle, swings down, seizes her, pulls her up to the cathedral, and you have to listen closely as he yells those famous words.
Sanctuary! Sanctuary! Thank heaven, the sanctuary will save her.
Oh no, she killed one of us and must die regardless. We will go to the king and force him to suspend sanctuary.
So people watching on a nearby balcony, a woman says, thank heaven the sanctuary will save us. And a man says, no, she killed one of us. She must die. And we will go to the king to suspend sanctuary. Funny, a word, Professor, that's very much in the news today, sanctuary.
Absolutely.
Was Notre Dame a sanctuary? Explain that.
So all churches were sanctuaries in the Middle Ages. There are places where civil law doesn't apply. So you can go to a religious site and claim sanctuary. And that actually worked in much more distant past around standing stones in the north of Europe, that these sites of worship could also be sites where the laws didn't apply and you could ask for sanctuary.
We'll talk more about what Victor Hugo was saying in the book and what the film then showed us about Notre Dame.
So it's absolutely a love story to the church and to this building. But Victor Hugo is not someone who is a fervent Catholic in this moment. And so in part what the book is about is thinking about this structure and why it matters in a world where kings and religion don't exist in the same way anymore. So you have to remember that Victor Hugo is writing after the French Revolution. He's a young man when he writes this book and sees the tumult of Napoleon, the tumult of the Restoration, and wonders what French civilization means once the kings and the church don't matter anymore.
Napoleon, who is another who oddly saved the cathedral and then crowned himself and his wife in it. And you mentioned the French Revolution, another time the building was sacked. It's amazing what this building has come back from.
Yes, it's amazing what it's come back from, but I think also we have to remember that in each of these instances of its return, it's been another layer of history that's written onto the building. And this is what's so interesting about buildings and cities, is that they sediment time. There are these accretions of time. So the spire was an original. It's added in the 19th century, but it's part of the building. And so in part, what we will have lost with this fire is that layering of history, that you could build a 19th century spire on top of a roof that's supported by 12th century oaks.
Yeah, which are gone.
Which are gone.
I just want to remind us of some of the words of Victor Hugo in the book that resonate now. It's difficult not to sigh, not to wax indignant before the numberless degradations and mutilations which time and men have both caused the venerable monument to suffer. Speaking about Notre Dame then and today.
Yeah, and that last night there was this moment where it looked like, were the walls going to fall? Were the firemen and women going to be able to save the actual physical stone structure? And it was saved. And in that moment, all I could think of was, will these walls survive? And they have. And that means it can be built again. And I'd like to add just another line from Hugo's novel in which he says, time is the architect, the people are the masons. So this is a structure that is built by time and history itself, and each generation adds their stones.
That's some comfort, yeah. You know, that we're maybe part of a continuum,
yeah.
Not the end.
Yeah.
MIT cultural historian Catherine Clark, thank you so much.
Thanks.
We know our next guest to be a sober, serious journalist. Jani Scott was part of the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning team in 2000. In 2001, she came up with the paper's profiles of 9/11 victims. She wrote the book A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Well, now she's turned her eye on her own family, and who knew? Jani Scott is a descendant of a railroad baron, bankers, Boston Brahmins, who all settled in the rarefied air of Philadelphia's main line, several generations living together at Ardrossan Farms, which Jani describes as a British estate plopped down in John Cheever land. Candelabras, ballrooms, a staff of 16 in the servants' dining room. Her grandmother, Helen Hope Montgomery, was said to be the inspiration for Katharine Hepburn's socialite Tracy Lord in the Philadelphia story. She couldn't tolerate weakness. In this scene, she speaks French to her sister to intimidate reporters.
Oh, j'espère bien que ce n'est pas le smallpox.
Le smallpox?
Mais oui, va dire à maman de se dépêcher.
Oh, how do you do?
I'm Tracy Lord.
But Jani Scott's grandmother welcomed all and every adventure. Jani's exploration of her forebears lands on her father, Robert Montgomery Scott, handsome, charming, beloved president of the Philadelphia Museum for years, and as Jani discovered when she found his diaries, fully aware that his drinking was killing him. Her new beautiful memoir is The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. We met up with Jani Scott in the Manhattan apartment she shares with husband Joe Lelyveld, former executive editor of The Times, and started by asking, what was it like to live at Ardrossan?
Well, it was this 800-acre stretch of spectacularly beautiful land with fieldstone farmhouses and barns and stables and a herd of cows. There was a swimming pool that had been built in the 20s in the woods. There was the remains of an old skating rink. There were tennis courts. My father had this pack of beagles, and in wintry days, we would sometimes take the beagles to exercise them along with toboggans and whisk down the hills on these toboggans chased by barking beagles and land in a heap at the bottom. My father called that toboggling.
There was also Helen Hope, grandma. Your grandfather, her husband, had gone to school with Philip Barry, who wrote the Philadelphia story. Was she the role model for Tracy Lord?
My grandmother is a very charismatic, colorful figure and flirtatious and many of the things that you see in Tracy Lord. But my grandmother fully understood that humans have weaknesses, in fact, rather celebrated that. But as my uncle said to me, you know, after a while, she came to value the importance of being Mrs. Philadelphia's story.
Talk a little bit about her life. I mean, you talk about going to Venice once. You're backpacking around Europe. And there are your grandparents hanging out with Jack Profumo, the disgraced British cabinet minister. She once got the Duke of Windsor to stand on his head because she wanted to see what was under his kilt. She sounded dazzling.
Well, she really was. Acquired a horse for a pound of caviar and a dirty joke every week for a year. Spectacularly good looking, physically daring. She did take her father's declining herd when he died against his will because he didn't think women should be involved with cows and turned it into what was said to be the most productive Ayrshire herd of its size in the country.
Yeah. She kept scrapbooks. She kept letters. She and her husband, they wrote to each other these unabashedly romantic, loving, needy love letters that you found. But also both your grandparents and your father had affairs. You went to visit your father in Nantucket.
And there ensued this weekend that I ended up spending with my father and a girlfriend I was completely unaware of in the house that my mother had bought for the family in Nantucket.
Things were not right. The alcohol consumption over generations, this high life, it's not Kardashian, it's Downton Abbey. In fact, you would miss Downton Abbey on Sunday nights, and one of your cousins or brothers said, well, we didn't miss Downton Abbey, we were Downton Abbey.
Right. Yes, we weren't missing Downton Abbey, this was Downton Abbey.
But these cracks start to appear. Your father's drinking, you and your siblings saw it, there was an intervention. Then you realized he knew more about it than you knew.
I had always known that my father kept diaries. In my 20s, out of the blue, he said to me that he wanted me to have them when he died. And I said to him, well, why me? And he said, you're the writer. It was extraordinary, beautifully written. The quality of his insight and his savage criticism of himself was just startling.
Do you mind reading some of that? I'm trying to find it.
I take my diary down from the shelf and I begin to write when I am in moods of reappraisal and reform. Formerly, the moods were short, a day or two of depression or elation. This time, it's been much longer. The urge to create for the satisfaction of creating, runs strong during those moods. I would try to write a novel, perhaps built on the projection of my grandfather Montgomery's life. There is nothing which I find exciting, stimulating, except the things which I do alone, unanalyzed and unspoken. Work, perhaps. Beagling, reading, drinking, perhaps. I am cold in the sense of being dead to so much. I am now 26 years old. I live in a beautiful formal house with grounds which I cannot afford to keep, on a decaying quasi-baronial domain of great beauty in an encroaching suburb. I am a graduate of a law school and paid to practice law by a rather good, stuffy law firm, and I am quite mediocre about it. I am married to a charming, spoiled wife with whom I have little in common but background. We live our background. Our house is our two generations of money flowing into more of culture. This is no way to live.
What was a joy for life in your grandmother? Was that manic depression in your father?
I don't know how to define what he had, but it's clear from the diaries that he had a sort of cyclical mood imbalance. And when I looked into other aspects of family history, his grandfather had committed suicide in France during the war, and he too appeared to have cycles of elation and depression. And my father did believe, apparently, that his grandfather had been bipolar. Maybe it was a tendency in that direction. I just don't know.
And there definitely was alcoholism later. But this is also a man who was called by all the papers in Philadelphia, the quintessential Philadelphian, who would hop on a bicycle with just a couple of tools, take you biking all over the world. What do you think, learning more about your father, what impact has that had on you?
I feel that it's given me much more empathy for him. I loved him deeply, and toward the end of his life, I was deeply frustrated by my inability to persuade him that he should try to stick around a bit longer, that he was drinking himself to death, that he had a problem that he had refused to acknowledge. The fact is, I learned long after his death from the diaries that he understood his drinking long before the rest of us did and wrestled with it for decades without even acknowledging that to us.
Having stepped back as the reporter that you are and taken this clear-eyed look at generations of a lot of wealth, what would you say about wealth?
What I would say, and the reason I called the book The Beneficiary, is that the more I looked at my father's life, and to some extent earlier members in his family, the more I thought about the weight of things that are passed on in families. Inheritance, not just of money, houses, land, but also of genes and values and culture. Just an excess of good fortune falling in one place and not in another. But it also shapes the decisions that people make or don't make at a point in their life where they may not really be conscious of how those things that are being passed on are shaping those decisions. My father made decisions early on in his life to plant himself in the place where he'd grown up, go into his great uncle's firm, to assume the place in Philadelphia society that they had. Those matter, those shape your whole life. And how much did he know? And the thing that was striking to me about that diary entry is that he saw very early on, in a way that I don't know that I would have had I not moved away and gone off and become a newspaper reporter, the trap that was sort of laid at his feet.
Yeah. a snare, as you said, that he stepped into.
Yeah.
The whole thing is a metaphor alert. We watch this gorgeous estate.
Ardrossan.
We watch it and him crumble.
Not just that out of this charmed life came this self-destructive end, rather tragic, premature end, but he had devoted the last almost 10 years of his life to restoring this 50-room mansion to its original perfection, a house that many objective observers would say has no place in 21st century life. That place survived on the will and ego of my grandmother and to some extent my father, when virtually every other estate like that that had been built around the turn of the 19th to 20th century is gone, and they were bent on keeping it going for some kind of romantic commitment to what it meant to their forebears.
Yeah, and also to prevent what, at one point you have a line, both the house and that way of life and his way of life,
the Lord of the Manor,
were both becoming extinct.
Yes, absolutely.
We're here in your West Side apartment, books everywhere. But the four homes, I think, Nantucket, Bar Harbor, the estate in Philadelphia, South Carolina. Is it here?
No.
And why is that?
You know, I have his umbrella that, as I tell in the book, this crazy effort to restore the umbrella by sending it back to London.
Right.
And I have his wallet. But
isn't that funny? After generations of great wealth and great art and great things, and what you have is this book.
Yes, true. Well, the tax on the art, we can't afford that art anymore. But yeah, I feel like the book is kind of my contribution.
And what you want to take from it. I mean, you didn't want
the material possessions. I mean, I feel like you go out and you make your own life. And in a way, I think that's the story. Not to criticize my father, because he was enormously productive and did wonderful things in the city of Philadelphia. But you see this theme in Philip Barry's plays about what happens if you accept a life that's imposed upon you instead of going out and making a life for yourself.
Music from The Philadelphia Story. Janie Scott's beautiful memoir, The Beneficiary, is out today. It's here and now.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
Retail is having a rough spring. Nearly 6,000 stores have closed this year. That's slightly more than all the stores that closed all of last year. And many thought retail, like 90s fashion, was having a comeback. What happened? Let's bring in Scott Horsley, now chief economics correspondent for NPR. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Robin. Good to be with you.
Well, and talk about what this now is, a retail apocalypse. You know, it's been going on for a while with online shopping, you know, killing off the brick and mortar. Remind us of the big picture.
Yeah, Americans are just doing more and more of their retail shopping online. About 16 cents of every consumer dollar is now spent online. And while that's great for the cardboard box business and UPS, it does mean less and less foot traffic at the shopping mall. And ultimately, a lot of stores are shutting their doors for good.
You know, there's some terrific reporting recently about how mills are producing more cardboard. You know, towns are coming back producing the cardboard for the Amazon boxes. But last year, there was some thinking that this was reversing, was it?
We saw a modest uptick in sales at brick-and-mortar stores last year. Consumer spending on the whole was fairly strong thanks to a good job market, rising take-home pay. And some chains, like Macy's, did report solid revenues. But overall, that was just sort of treading water against this big wave that's coming. The holiday shopping season was a disappointment. Sales were down a little bit in February. And more than those monthly ups and downs, there's just this steady migration to online, and that's the big story. Analysts from UBS expect that trend is just going to continue. They're projecting another 75,000 store closings by 2026.
Wow. And there were 12,000 retail jobs lost last month, even as the economy added nearly 200,000 jobs overall. But be more specific about some of the stores that aren't making it and maybe some that are.
You know, Payless Shoe Source is closing all of its stores around the country. Likewise, Gymboree. Of course, Sears continues to shrink. You know, Robin, I grew up wearing tough skins. I bought my first razor at Sears, but I have not found a reason to go into Sears in a long time, and a lot of shoppers are in the same boat. We should remember, Sears itself was once the great disruptor, the Amazon of its time, with its own catalog mail order business. And do keep in mind, while we have lost more than 140,000 retail jobs since the beginning of 2017, we've also gained more than 440,000 warehouse and transportation jobs. So this is a good example of, you know, creative destruction. That doesn't make it easy if you're in the retail business.
Right. It may not be the same job. I mean, you may not be the one who wants to drive the Amazon truck if you were in fashion, you know, in a store. But there's repurposing. I mean, at one point, malls were being turned over to walkers, people who walk the malls. But now you've got trampoline parks, Eataly, the gourmet Italian grocer. One analytics firm says this is purposeful. There's experiential tenants.
Right. Selling the experience more than something you take home in a shopping bag. Lots of experimentation. I'm not sure anybody's really found a winning formula. The Wall Street Journal reported today that mall vacancy rates in the first quarter hit 9.3%. That's the highest that's been since 2011. There are, though, some counterexamples of this trend, Robin. Companies that were born online, like Warby Parker, that are actually opening up brick-and-mortar stores. That's probably more for marketing, though, than a real serious channel to reach their customers. They're still going to be primarily an online retailer.
So an important shift. I mean, people who are losing jobs and maybe neighborhoods that are seeing big, hunky, hulking buildings. But just, you know, way down on the list of concerns, where are kids hanging out?
They're probably locked in their room, glued to their telephones.
All right, Scott Horsley, Chief Economics Correspondent. Thank you.
Good to be with you, Robin.
Let's get back to our top story today, the fire at Notre Dame in Paris. And joining us now is French philosopher and author Bernard-Henri Lévy. Welcome back to Here and Now. And first, what are your thoughts today?
I'm so sad, so sad. As every French citizen, as every citizen of Paris, I spent all night awake crying. And we stopped crying, I at least stopped crying this morning when I was sure that the fire had been mastered. Till then, it was like each of us was wounded. This Cathedral of Notre Dame is not only, it's not just a monument, it is the heart of Paris, it is the soul of France, it is a masterpiece of European civilization. It would have been a huge loss, impossible to repair if it had been thoroughly destroyed.
Well, and the good news, I guess, if there is some good news in this, is that many of the important artifacts inside were saved. The building is still standing. What is lost, though?
What is lost is, for example, the roof, the wooden roof of the cathedral, which is 7, 8 centuries old, is lost, is burnt. And, you know, you cannot rebuild, you cannot reconstitute 8 centuries of age and of time. You can make it fake, of course, but it will be a fake forever. There is something in the smell, in the visible age of a wall or of a roof, which the best architect cannot rebuild. And this is lost forever.
I have to ask, you know, as I was watching this yesterday, and as many people were watching this yesterday, you think to yourself, how could this possibly happen in this place, one of the jewels of this world? How could this happen? What do you think?
Because we did not take care enough. And this could happen again in other monuments in Europe and in France if we don't decide to consider these sort of architectural monuments as our most precious jewels, as treasures, And this is not the way we conceive them. We are not conscious enough in France and in Europe in general. We are not conscious enough of the spiritual price, of the quantity of beauty embedded in these sorts of monuments. So we know the age. We know they are threatened. We know there is decay going on, but we don't care. And in a way, we care less than you do, Americans. You are a young nation, but maybe for that, you are more attached. You take care more of your young monuments than us of our old monuments. And this has to change in emergency. If not, we will have other catastrophes of the same sort.
Do you think that the French authorities made the right decision in not doing what President Trump suggested on Twitter yesterday, which was to drop water from the air on top of Notre Dame? They said that that may have destroyed the entire structure if they had done that. But do you think that they acted quickly enough that they made the right choices in how to fight the fire?
I am not a specialist, but I think President Trump was not right. In the particular circumstance of Notre Dame de Paris, the water from the sky was, alas, impossible. No, I think the French authorities made the right decision. The wrong decision was not to cherish this treasure as a part of ourselves. But this is a wrong decision since ages, centuries. There was a French writer, Maurice Barrès, at the beginning of the 20th century, who wrote a book called The Great Pity of the Churches of France. The Great Pity of the Churches of France. And he already said that there was there an accumulation of treasures, a petrification of beauties, which were part of the inheritage, intellectual, artistic, and spiritual of France, and that we were dropping them flat. So here we are.
Many have remarked on the politics going on in France at the moment. The New York Times headline today is, "A France in turmoil weeps for a symbol of Paris's enduring identity." How do you think what happened yesterday at Notre Dame fits into the political situation in France right now, where we've seen other monuments burned on purpose?
What I hope today is that President Macron will find the words and will have the gestures to reassure the French nation, who is wounded by what happened yesterday night. The happy thing, the good news, is the chain of solidarity which has been immediately organized in France and out of France, with so many people from America, from the rest of Europe, showing their solidarity to Paris. What happens is Notre Dame, there is a sort of we are all French, we are all wounded French all over the world, which makes a warm heart. This morning, I had two sighs of relief. One, when I heard that the fire had been mastered thanks to the brave firemen. And second, when I heard that all over the world there was this wind, this tide of solidarity, showing to the French people again that they were not alone. As after the Charlie Hebdo attack, as after the hyper-cacher anti-Semitic attack, and so on. And this, for a Frenchman, is such a relief to see that in these tragic moments, the world is with us, and in particular, America.
Finally, let me just ask you, what do you think France will need now to recover from this?
A huge plan to take care of all these beauties that history, not God, history gave us. There was the finger of destiny on our head, us, French nation, which created such an accumulation of pieces of intelligence, of pieces of sophistication, of pieces of beauty, of pieces of living poetry, poetry in stone, intelligent stone, because a monument like Notre Dame is not just beautiful, it is a masterpiece of spirit. And we are the guardians of all of this. We have to take care of. We don't own them. They are not given as a gift. No, we have to prevent them from dying. We have the duty, the sacred duty of taking care. And this is what the French government will have to be conscious of. We have the duty of being the custodian, the guardians of our memory and of our treasuries, as you do in America with all your museums all around the country. Even in small towns, you have a piece of beauty, of spiritual wealth. You make a museum around it, and you take care of it as you take care of a child or of a baby. This is what we have to relearn, us French people.
That is French philosopher and author Bernard-Henri Lévy. Thank you so much for joining us. And as has been said so many times, our thoughts here in this country are with you and all the people of France today.
Thank you.
British filmmaker Mike Leigh's latest is called Peterloo. It's based on an actual event in 1819, and it marks the third period piece in a row for a filmmaker who's been celebrated for decades for his original stories about everyday people today. Films like Secrets and Lies, Vera Drake, Happy-Go-Lucky. Howie Moshevitz of member station KUNC reports on Leigh's interest in the past and how he brings it into the present.
On August 16, 1819, British cavalry and volunteers attacked a crowd of roughly 60,000 peaceful demonstrators in Manchester, England. An estimated 18 people were killed and more than 500 wounded. The massacre climaxes Mike Leigh's new film.
Gentlemen, forbear! Forbear! The people cannot get away!
The event was dubbed the Peterloo Massacre because it took place on St. Peter's Field, and witnesses considered its brutality a mockery of the famed Battle of Waterloo less than 4 years earlier. Filmmaker Mike Leigh grew up in Manchester.
I grew up very close to where it happened, but the weird thing is, many of us grew up really not knowing about it. But it's a major event in the history of democracy in this country. People at Peterloo were, as much as anything, protesting because only 2% of the population had the vote. So it was a demonstration for the vote, for suffrage.
Leigh's film started a debate in England after it opened there last year about why the story's not taught in schools.
Of course, it doesn't fit into two of the main ways of telling history.
Pamela Hutchinson's a British film critic.
One of which is the idea that there's progress, because the immediate effect of the Peterloo rally was not any kind of progress in the cause of reform. That came later and in different ways. And because, of course, it's not the history of great men, great leaders, it's the history of the working class roots movement.
Dear sisters, welcome to the Manchester Female Reform Society.
They said we've got to pay, but I'm not paying because I haven't got out to give.
There is no money to be given if you do not have it.
To tell that story, Leigh worked on a far larger scale than ever before, with 160 characters. He built his story on painstaking research, and he still used the approach he's taken with other films, such as Life is Sweet and Vera Drake. He and his cast improvised sequences to nail down the final script and bring out the stories of everyday people caught up in an enormous historical event.
Although the scale is different, and obviously the issues are unique to this film, the truth is that you're still looking at a huge number of individuals. I mean, it's one of my films, and what I try and do as best I can is to look at people in detail, in three dimensions, and as soon as you do that, you're looking at people as lived lives.
Many of those people are women, says Pamela Hutchinson.
one of the things I think that's really a strong inclusion in Mike Leigh's film is it shows that there was a great movement of women involved in this demand for political reform, that they were there supporting the cause of suffrage and political reform. And also, you see, I think there are a few voices already calling for the idea of women's suffrage, which didn't happen until after the First World War.
We come together as wives, mothers, daughters and sisters in our social, domestic and moral capacities. May our flag never be unfurled, but in the sacred cause of liberty, peace and reform. And then, may a female's curse pursue the coward who deserts the standard.
A lot of what you hear in Peterloo is actually direct quotes from what people actually said or wrote.
That focus on people keeps the camera in the midst of the crowd during the massacre.
There are no aerial shots. There are no helicopter shots, no drone shots. You know, you're down there in and amongst it with the people. You know, it's very important for it to be alive in that sense, for us not to detach ourselves from it. The job was to make it real, make it as real as possible. That's why we deliberately shot it in that way, so that, you know, you really did feel the claustrophobia of the thing, the oppressiveness of it. Otherwise, it's, you know, you're kind of letting the audience off the hook.
Mike Leigh wants his audience engaged and uncomfortable. He also wants them to realize the importance of the struggle those 60,000 people were waging when they were attacked, and that Peterloo is not simply a movie about something that happened nearly 200 years ago.
It's about people's voice, people having the vote. They didn't. 2% of the population in this country had the vote 200 years ago. We're dealing with important matters of people's lives and how they lived their lives and people's needs and aspirations and hopes. And I mean, the people who were at Peterloo would be appalled to discover, if they were to jump in a time machine and leap down to now, that in this country, everybody has the vote, but many people are cynical about it and don't use it. They would be shocked and horrified and, I think, profoundly disgusted by that.
So Peterloo is not just about Britain. For NPR News, I'm Howie Mofsovitz.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.